WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively celebrating 31 years amongst friends. We are at Costas. I'm wearing the shirt. They've got holiday parties here. Imagine that during the holidays at the famous establishment here in Dundalk, Acostas. They have that going on. The Maryland Lottery is bringing it all together for us today. I'm going to be giving away some, not just some Raven scratch-offs, but I've got like a whole new batch, thanks to Roz, of the holiday cash drops. John Allen is here. We got our friends here from Hammer Jacks and a documentary, and we're going to be telling old rock and roll stories. Gina Schock's going to be here a little later on. Penguins at East Point Mall, I'm sure will be involved, John Allen. But these folks, well, first off, Anne-Marie's from the Dina. Anne-Marie, I've known for 30 years. I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to date too much of us. And, of course, Steve is here as well.
Wait a second. Didn't you just do it, though?
No, I don't know. No, no, no.
Just a little
35
bit.
Plus one. She's 36. Come
okay,
on now.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, Steve, of course, you guys came to me year and a half ago and said we're going to put together. Hold that. That's an original. Hammer Jacks documentary is what you're going to put together.
Yeah.
I had an advanced screening. John has had an advanced screening. He and I have only spoken very, very briefly about the memories we saw. But my wife said she hasn't seen me smile in 90 minutes straight, yelling at... We didn't watch it on a TV. We watched it on a computer screen. I'm screaming. Look at that. Hey, they got John. Hey, you know, talking to somebody else. Congratulations on doing something I think John and I would both agree was a part of our childhood that you guys have captured in a way and a part of our life that brought it back to life. And you said you had 500 hours of guys like us telling stories, right?
Yeah, well, 50, yeah, but that's enough to get through in an edit. But John goes back on this. We started working on this thing about 6 years ago, so
yeah,
it's been
three,
a long...
At least three haircuts ago.
At least
yes.
Three haircuts, right? Yeah, yeah.
I saw myself up there. I was like, whoa!
Yeah, so it was a long process. A lot of people to talk to. A lot of people wanted to be involved. But, you know, it's also a lot of pressure, too, because, like you were saying, it's this Hammer Jacks meant a lot to a lot of people. And it was a big part of a lot of our lives. So to try to get that right, to make people try to revisit that time a little bit in a good way, you know, it's a big task. And I certainly couldn't have gone too far. I started before I met Anne-Marie, but then Anne-Marie came on board and everything just opened up because...
What did you know about Hammer Jacks? Do you have a background story with it?
Yeah. So I went to University of Maryland. And I was an intern for WHFS, we'd go out and do shows there quite a bit. And I was actually at a wedding, Nisi, the DJ that I worked with, got married in the club, so I had that story. But I have stories if you want to hear some. My favorite one is that it's the only time I ever got a girl's phone number in a bar ever.
Ever?
Ever. Was it Hammer Jacks?
Was it real? Was the number real?
You know what? Unfortunately, it was. Because what happened was that I ended up calling her, you know, late at night like a complete dunce. And and
mom
she
answered.
Was... Yes! Still living with her folks, and so I froze and hung up, right? You remember Star 69, right?
Oh, yeah.
Called me right back and just let it ring. And I eventually picked up, and they're like, yeah, she lives with her parents, and you don't call here. And I'm like, thanks, tell her I called or something, right? That was the end of that. That was the end of that. But, yeah, Hammer Jacks was so wide open that even I could get a phone number in that place, right?
Oh, man, you're giving me stories about girls now that I'm recollecting stories. I met a woman there. I mean, I was a kid, Anne-Marie, and I told her. I was 17 years old in Hammer Jacks, right?
Yeah.
And I always thought that I was younger than you because you were tending bar there. And it turns out that I'm older than... So, I mean, it's that time period of 1988, 89, 90, 91. The coming of age, I would say. I was there one night, and I was the music critic, right? So I was backstage. And she wasn't a woman, but she was in her 20s, and I might have not have been, right? I was certainly old enough to drive, and I was there. And I always had an extra ticket for review, so I could always kind of get a hot date or at least a guy to hang out, somebody that wanted to use me. So this woman said Scorpion show was next week, and I'm like, yeah, I got, you know, I'll go to Scorpions with you. And I mean, she was kind of so hot to trot that I couldn't even, I was, you know, I was a kid, right?
Yeah, yeah.
She said, well, I live down in Greenbelt. Come down and we'll go in my car and you can park your car here. And I'm like, okay, cool. She had like this burnt orange Porsche 911.
Whoa, yeah.
And I'm like the 19-year-old kid from Dundalk, you know, with I was intimidated. But these are the kind of women you met at Hammer Jacks. You could meet anybody at Hammer Jacks. Oh, yeah. As was to the point where you think, I mean, the wrestlers would come through, rock stars would come through. And for you, Anne Marie, to have been a bartender there and to have been privy to in and out and backstage and all that stuff, why this doc? Like, what about this thing made it work? Because, I mean, you knew everyone. You had everybody's phone number to be able to make it good, right?
Yeah, it's so many stories and just the people that we all still, we're all still kind of like a family, you know? I always talk about Facebook and, you know, all the mutual friends that you have. You know, I've got 300, 400 mutual friends, like probably John. And a lot of those people are just, you know, they're all from the Hammer Jacks days. And we still, you know, we see each other at shows. And it's just a big family. And it always, it's just warms my heart that, you know, we can still go back and reminisce and just to be able to do this documentary was great, to be able to get people back together and you know, share their experiences, and it was a lot of fun.
It was a huge undertaking. I mean, they told a story. I mean, you saw it. So, you know, the club started its life as one thing, you know, on Charles Street, South Charles Street. And then it moved to, you know, which they found out was an old brewery, this old warehouse building. And that was, you know, it was called, you know, the club side initially, before they built the concert hall, before there were bands playing there.
I remember the night Eddie Money played in the MTV Jocks game, but I was just a 98 Rock, I was just a kid, right? I mean, I couldn't get in. I was too young. I mean, I remember seeing the date from, you had the flyer and all that, and I'm like, I was like 15, 16 years old,
and that
right?
was the opening of the concert hall?
Yes.
Concert hall, yeah.
Okay.
My parents were there that night, and actually the ticket stub we used in the film was my mom's, mom and dad's. So,
well, I mean, these mementos and things, and Bud Becker, obviously, was a part of this, and I probably should have invited Bud over here today to be a part of this. He's such a part of the historian and sharing pictures. He has all the Keith Van Doren's pictures, right?
Oh, yeah. So all a good percentage of the photography in the film comes from Bud.
Well,
yeah.
And he was the voice. Like, when you heard those Hammer Jacks ads on 98 Rock, you know, it was like, whoa. Like, as soon as you heard Bud's voice, you know, the club that rules the street, Hammer Jacks.
Yeah. Right,
you
know,
you're like, whoa, yeah. You know, it's like you made it, you know, if you were in the one of those ads with Bud's great timber.
Well, it's rich with stories, right? I mean, when you're talking about sourcing something, I don't know what it means outside of Baltimore, outside of the Mid-Atlantic area, or what it would mean to rock and roll bands that are scattered around, or the legend of it being on, you know, the cover of a Motley Crue album, or just that they're these, it was an iconic thing, even if you just drove through Baltimore to see the giant orange sign that literally sat above the freeway. It was its own billboard. It was the thing you saw when you drove into Baltimore when there was no football stadium here, right? Like, it was the thing that glowed like Las Vegas. Steve Naranjus, correct?
That is correct.
All right. Yeah. Anne-Marie is here, as well as John Allen from... should I just say Stone Horses? Wait, what am I going to... Because there's a rumor, Child's Play, I saw it on a bill, and it was new, and it's empty. What's going on with you, man? I got to get this involved here.
Yeah, we're playing the M3 Festival this year, May 6th, I think. I think we're supposed to be the first band on the main stage.
That gets us there early then.
Yeah. I don't know what time that is, but...
Well, I hope it's not 112 degrees, because I'm going to be sticking... Styx is playing that night, right?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. I hope it's warm, yeah. I hope it's 100 degrees. It's going to be great.
That's a great bill that day. Lita Ford's playing, Red Extreme's playing, Winger's playing. It's going to be a lot
of
fun.
Well, that's a Hammer Jacks reunion. I mean, all
really
of
is,
us,
yeah.
the people who love your bands, I should say, over the course of years, to come together. Music's what brings people together. It was the thing that made Hammer Jacks. Hammer Jacks was the music part of this. You sent me some sort of soundtrack thing today. And put in the doc together. I didn't know what to expect, right? You guys invited me down. My whole involvement in this, John, was... Anne Marie hit me and said, "We're doing a doc. Will you tell stories?" And I'm like, "Oh, I got stories, you know." So I came down. You set me up on the stage at Merriweather and some other folks. I saw Brian Forbes when I was coming in and out, and I sat down for an hour. And we walked out. And I kidded to my wife. I'm like, "God, I hope I just get 10 seconds. I mean, I gave some pretty good stories there. You gave me an hour of the reel that I'm going to cut up, and I'm going to release all of my stories. But you had everybody's stories,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, my involvement was minimal. Your thing, man, you made him look all sexy against a brick wall. He was, like, standing there, like a rock star. You were in it a lot, and as far as, and he's such a history buff anyway,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And living through it, but finding these stories and things that I didn't even know, like the Guns N' Roses night. Were you not at the Guns N' Roses show?
I was there, yeah.
Oh, do tell. I was not there that night.
Well, I can only tell secondhand stuff because I wasn't backstage. But I know what I heard about. I know what I saw on stage. And I know what the dressing room smelled like after they played them. But yeah, it was crazy. I mean, I was upstairs watching them on Slash's side. And I decided to move to the front where the sound man was, mixed position. So I got there and moved around. I'm watching them. I'm like, man, it sounds amazing. I mean, they were on. They were killing it. They're just on fire. The beginning of the tour, you know, just great. And then I realized there was only one guitar in the PA. And that was Slash's. And so I focused in on Izzy straddling, and he was just falling all over the stage. And I noticed it was really weird. You know, he had a big amp stack, a Mesa Boogie stack. There was this huge Samoan-looking guy standing behind the amplifier. And so I'm like, I noticed how Izzy was kind of, you know, stumbling. And I noticed the big guy, he reaches out and he turns the knob down on the amp head. He's turning his volume down. I'm like, oh, man, like Road Crew guy turning his guitar down. I'm like, it must be really bad. It's not in the PA. Like, wow, what's going on? Well, just then, Izzy Stradlin turns around from the front of stage, runs back, and just rolls all the knobs to 10, right? He knew what was going on. He knew they were turned out, right? Then he runs to the front of stage again. The big guy's standing there. And then he does this backwards run and slams into the amp stack. The whole thing buckles. It all would have gone down, except this dude was like the size of like a football player, like a lineman. Holds on to the amps, keeps them from falling, and Izzy's leaning against the amps, like, you know, he's just holding both of them up. He runs to the front of stage again. At the end of the set, he takes off this like $3,000 Gibson hollow body and he throws it into the audience. I'm like, wow. Yeah.
Like, that's rock and roll.
That's totally rock and roll. That dude, I don't know what he's on, but he's wasted.
Man. Hammerjack's the good old days.
You know,
right?
That's one of my favorite parts of the film, because one of the reasons you make a documentary like this, yeah, right, is to try to hold on to everybody's memories,
right,
of these events. And that part of the film,
it's hilarious.
It's great because everybody's
got different memories.
Yeah. Especially the part about the, you know, urinating in the back, because somebody's like, you know, it was Izzy on, in one of their books, they said Izzy took a leak on the manager's desk, right? And Steve Kitchens is like, no, it was Slash in the vending machine.
Right.
Right? It was Mike Brillhart. It's like, no, it was Izzy on the CO2 tanks. So it's like everybody had a slight, it's all close, right? But everybody has a slightly different memory of what went down.
And I heard it was the dressing room that we're in.
Right.
And I swear it smelled like it afterwards. It smelled like
for the next 3 weeks.
No, it was like the next year or two. Yeah, it like never went away. Yeah. And that was like,
he pissed excellence is what you're telling me.
Oh my God.
That's right. Oh, man.
But those dressing rooms too, they were pristine prior to that. Like we had played so many dives, you know, coming up.
And Hammerjacks was nice.
Oh, it was so nice. It was like, we had two rooms. There was a bathroom
shower.
In the middle with a shower.
Yeah, remember the shower?
I'm sure nothing went down in there.
No.
Never.
No, totally. But I never showered in there.
You should ask Louis for the footage of that.
Absolutely. I bet he's got it.
I was afraid of my feet sticking to the bottom of it. But there was no graffiti on the dressing room walls. I mean, it was like perfect. And then after that Guns N' Roses show, it was like, oh, man.
It just became another gig. John Allen's here. We're at Costas. We're celebrating 31 years. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery, as well as our friends at Goodwill and Win the Nation, 866-90-NATION. Giving you a better deal than they gave me, honestly. It's 0% financing. You buy two, you get two free. You definitely need it on these cold days. It is a cold holiday. I love that the tree's here. Gina Shock's coming by later. Michael Gell's already here from Milkshake and Beyond Words. We're going to be telling old rock and roll story. That's more Marble Bar, right? Like, literally, that's like even a generation before. We're going to talk punk rock. You and I were kids in the 70s when Gina Shock was doing her thing and making her way westward. Anne-Marie, I want to ask you about the, not just the Guns N' Roses night, but these stories, because you were one of the people firing questions at me on the stage at Meriwether to try to jog my memory about what was the best show, what's the memory, what do you remember about the being in the, everybody had a memory of hitting the backstage red button and looking up and waving up at the video, and it took me until today to
get in the back door.
I was one of the guys in there. I'd look on the little black and white, and I was hitting the button in the office, letting people, that's the band. You might want to let them in. You know what I mean?
Well, you know what's great about that? I was like, everybody's like, oh, this exclusive thing where you go to the back door. I'm like, well, everybody got in the back door. So wasn't that exclusive, man? Everybody we talked to was getting back in.
Well, everybody had a story. That was the way you, there was only one door. Yeah. And there was no bounce. It was a garage door.
Well, I remember early on, there may have been a secretary or someone at the desk who would, you know, judge whether you were worthy to come in. They'd hit the buzzer. But
it was usually Anne Marie or Jill.
Well, there was usually somebody there, like full, you know, manning it full, you know, full time. But yeah, there was a lot of times when we just look up and okay.
I was total Wayne's World. I was like, hold my pass up,
right,
you know.
Right.
That's
one, I remember one day I went down. I had band rehearsal that night, but I knew there was a big show in town playing there. It was Oasis. It was on their first tour.
Wow.
And I went down, I hit the buzzer, somebody let me in. I walked in, it was Liam Gallagher.
No way.
He was sitting behind the desk with a Heineken.
Your hair is long enough, you're in.
That's hilarious.
And he kept hitting the buzzer, he's like, he was messing with me, and I was like, all right, fucker. Like,
that's
you know. And it was Liam, and he was drinking a Heineken at like 4 in the afternoon.
That's great.
So this, I mean, it's jogging memories here that are amazing. 2 days ago is the 5-year anniversary of the death of Pat D'Anizio from the Smithereens.
Yeah.
Pat and I were close. The band and I still close to this day. Jimmy Babjack, those guys. There's a picture of me with Mike, Dennis, Jimmy, and Pat on the top of the stairs. I'm wearing The Lost. They were a band, The Lost. I'm wearing a Lost shirt for some reason. I think Maria Malta from Atlantic Records gave me that, and I was trying to pimp her band. It was a cool shirt. It was black. It said The Lost on it.
Yeah.
So I'm wearing that. And that picture showed up in my timeline Tuesday, and I knew I was getting together with you guys. And I just randomly, it was so much about the movie, watching it once, that I didn't, like, take notes or whatever, but just came back to me. So I'm watching it, and I'm waiting for myself, and I'm seeing John, and I'm waiting for myself, and I'm hearing stories, and I'm pointing, and I'm there's Kitches, and I'm telling old stories, Tom Perry. And at the end of your film, you had video footage of walking down the backstage steps, the steps that I was on, and it, like, I got, like, it hit me, and I'm like, holy shit, like, I haven't been there in 30 years. That's still a place.
Yeah.
Now, it is a space above where tailgates have been blowing, you know, barbecue in that parking lot, because it's literally that airspace is the tailgate lot where the Ravens are, right?
Yeah.
Parking lot D or whatever it would be at this point. But I'm thinking to myself, that's like a rock and roll cosmic space that's gone.
Yeah.
That stairwell, every Oasis, every Guns N' Roses, Kiss. I mean, just go through Debbie Harry. I mean, anybody that was ever there, and you can name them all, that step, everybody went upstairs because the dressing room was nice. You didn't have to hang out in the bus. You could come upstairs, and it was cold beer, and you could breathe a little bit, and it was really cordoned off. There was only one way up, was one stairwell, so you kind of had to have some privilege to get there. It was private,
you had to go through the office, and then there was an open area, and then that rickety, it looked rickety, it wasn't, but it was like, it was
they were wooden.
They were old wooden steps that went up and then went to the right and went up to
that giant safe that was back there, backstage too.
Yeah.
But those steps, man, after watching an hour of these stories and learning stuff I didn't know, I mean, literally, I didn't know as much about Nobles and, you know, that space. I knew it was there, but I didn't have pictures or...
Sure.
And you had bartender, you had stories, but that piece got me. And John and I were going back and forth. The part I think he and I laughed the most about was Louis was still the star of your documentary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, and as he should be, right?
Yeah. 100%.
I mean, like, totally... I mean, we're talking characters of all characters.
Oh, my God.
He's it.
I mean, you talk about hard to edit out stories, man. He had so much good stuff. You know, you wanted to leave every second of what he was saying.
He has his own documentary. Right?
There's a good story about that footage of the staircase, too. Because what happened with that, you know, when we started working on this, we were sort of doing it on our own, and it was pretty quiet. But as things, as we got closer to the end, people were finding out about it, and people were coming out of the woodwork like, hey, I'd love to do something. Let me give you some music. Yeah. Let me give you some pictures. Mm-hmm. So there's a filmmaker named Rudy Childs who's local, but he's done a lot of photography for, like, Priest and stuff like that, like big stuff. Yeah. And he got in touch, and he's like, hey, and I looked up all his credits. I'm like, oh, man, this guy's done some stuff. And he's
was he part of the heavy metal parking lot? Did he shoot some of that?
No. He's friends with those guys. He worked on a Heavy Metal Picnic. A lot of that was his footage.
Okay.
So Rudy got in touch and is like, hey, I got all this backstage footage from Hammerjacks. Would you like to have a look at it? I'm like, dude, yeah, but I don't know if I can afford. He's like, no. It's free. Just take it.
Nice.
And we already had the story about the CO2 tanks, and I'm looking at that, and the guys are walking down from the band Hawaii. Mm-hmm. They're walking down the steps. I'm like, there's the CO2. The tanks. There they are. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's the vending machine, and there's everything. It's like, so.
Well, all watching this, it as a fan, it was a there you. It was an oh my god moment.
Well, you got
it.
Well, and
you save that to the end.
You have to know,
movie,
as
right?
somebody that's like editing the film, when you're a year into the edit and you've heard the story over and over, and then there's video of that exact thing. It's like, oh my god, this is the greatest. So I'm glad you picked that part out, because that's, you know, that's really special. That footage is like the chances that somebody took video of walking down the steps is ludicrous.
Well,
you know?
Brillhart's DJ booth that sat off the office, that literally
you had to kind of walk through it.
It kind of was like the walls. It was in the walls between the two clubs, you know, and he hid back. He has the great stories of hiding people there because it was a great place to hide. I hid there anytime Kitchis or Perry, like, dude, you got a ghost, they don't want a music critic back here, just go hang out, just hide with Brillhart till the band goes on stage. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And literally, I have those memories of all of that, but video footage of all of it was so available for bands. You're banging the Skins on stage with Child's Play. I mean, Kick stuff, like, it was a special place to play. And if you had a camcorder, a Hi-8 1989, and you were chips enough from enough, this is probably a place where you pulled the video camera out a little bit. If you were, as Gina Shock was for the Go-Go's, a documentarian mm-hmm. for your band, mm-hmm. right? Literally.
Right. Yeah.
How much stuff did you get that you couldn't use of that sort of magnitude?
Oh, tons of stuff. I mean, just interview stuff is, like I said before, probably 50 hours worth of stuff that we haven't released. That, you know, there are things that some people have great interviews where it's just like you can't use it all, and some people talk for an hour. And they only got 45 seconds worth of good stuff. But you got a lot of footage, right? But, you know, there's also a lot of video that exists that we don't have access to. It's old VHS stuff and that kind of thing. Of like, basically, every band that played for a 4 or 5 year stretch in the late 80s, early 90s exists.
So everything was pro shot.
Well, there was a camera right at the soundboard. And whether you knew it or not as the band, somebody was videoing you.
Right.
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 You were big, because I
have a Kicksport. I have a Crack the Sky.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have them on VHSs that I bought at a flea market in 1993. Yeah. You know, literally, or somebody dropped it off and gave it to me. And I don't know that I have it. It says Kicks on it, Hammerjacks, December 1988, or whatever. And I know it's that. I mean, it wasn't held. It wasn't a cell phone. So I know there's some quality to it, other than the cellular falling apart or whatever point. But I'm figuring people were offering that sort of stuff to you. Right?
And there's a lot of stuff that exists too with musicians that we don't have any contact with and weren't interviewed, and it didn't make as much sense to put it in the film. A lot of the footage that we used from live bands was, you know, included people that we interviewed that wanted to be part of it.
Sure.
So there's stuff that exists that is just like, you know, Ace Frehley on stage and stuff like that, whereas we don't have any real connection with that. Steve Kitchis is calling. Hey, Steve.
But talked to him last week.
Our ears are buzzing.
But also, man, you know, tons of photography that we didn't get to fit in. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures that are great.
So many
that just didn't,
that...
you know, didn't have a spot for it, or you know, you have one picture in the film, you find one that works a little bit better, so you drop out the original picture, and it's just like so much stuff that's
available.
That
was the biggest challenge for me doing all the photos, and there's so many photos, and we wanted to try to get in as many bartenders and. But it was hard. It was really hard to do that.
Yeah, I think for Anne-Marie in particular, because she knew everybody. For me, it's all just people. It's like, that's a good picture. That's a cool-looking picture of a bartender. For her, it's like, oh, that person passed away, and this year,
have
this
to
person...
include that.
Yeah. I got a great story about this person, that kind of thing. So
Well, there's a lot of people are alive, right? And more than that, everybody, it's a special time in people's lives. It's special to me. It's special to you. In different, and it's different in every way.
Yeah.
You made money there. You were trying to, you know, play stadiums there. I mean, you were just there to have a good time for College Park. I was there working. Like, every, you know, and so much, I think, came out of it into the documentary that was meaningful to me. You know, like, how did you feel? Because you and I haven't even talked about it. I was going to ask you before they got here, if you got here early, I was going to say, hey, man, tell me how you really felt about it. I know you love Louis. Louis was the star, the graffiti, right?
Louis was incredible.
The graffiti.
Graffiti cannons.
So, Louis is a character. I mean, he told me stories back then that you probably left out, right? Because he went through a really excessive phase. Yeah. Like, you know, he was on top of the world, man. Like, you know, remember the scene in Scarface with the mountain of white sucker? He told me that there was a period where, you know, that was his life, you know? And I mean, things were really wrong. The club was open 7 days a week. They never closed. I went up there one time on a Monday night in a snowstorm.
Oh, yeah.
And there were still 325 people in there, right?
There weren't that many people there, but they were open.
Yeah.
They were open for business. And the thing about the club that was, they didn't do music, you know, until later, and they didn't do it with a frequency until later. It was all predicated on, I mean, the place was packed at midnight on a Saturday night, you know, like, people, it would be empty until like 11:30, and then by midnight it was jammed. And it was a, like you talked about meeting the girl, it was a pickup place. I mean, it was massive, massive meat market.
The thing that you really caught for someone like my son, who's now 37, who went to the second building he built down on
Guilford.
I was going to say center, but that's what I think by the DAC. My son had been in that building, and I'm like, dude, this is pretty much almost piece for piece what Hammerjacks looked like. It was an incredible thing. But the ingress and egress of people from room to room, because it was a house of rooms.
Yeah, right.
And you would go in and out of these rooms.
Yeah, you did the circuit.
It was you would walk around and see, because you was in, you didn't have text. You could to find, if I knew you were there for BAD that night and I was there and I'm like, meet me there, how would you find anyone in there, right? So you would walk around, and that's the meat market. You're like, it came back to everybody was looking at it was like a boardwalk.
Yeah.
Literally, all night long, no one ever sat still in Hammerjack.
It was such a massive club with the different courtyards, as they said, you know. And I just remember, I was just a memory talking about on the walkie-talkies and, you know, Mo to courtyard three. Mo is in courtyard three. You know,
we need more Bud Dry. We need more Bud Dry.
Oh, my God. But, I mean, it was a great place. I mean, just an insane place. And then, when you were back to your original question, when we finally had the opportunity to play the place, because only Nationals played it up to this point. And so what did they do?
It was big. You had to sell a lot of tickets.
Yeah.
Right,
what did they do? They put the locals in on a Monday night.
Right. In a snowstorm.
like the worst night, you know, you could fathom, right? We'll let the locals in. And we did like 800 people on a Monday night. It was awesome.
Yeah,
you know, we thought that was really impressive.
It's too big to play the Seagull anymore.
Oh, man. the Seagull just closed.
It's closed. Yeah,
yeah. It's just all closed.
No, we don't put them out of business now.
The Showboat. No. No,
you know who was the happiest about that? The people lived on Middleborough Road.
and Nanticoke. One night when we played down there, this is off topic, but
just like Poison open for you?
No. No, this is, we opened for Jim Danny's Black Oak, Arkansas.
Oh, man.
And I saw a girl that I went to high school with, and we went somewhere else, and as we were coming back, the bar was letting out, and she's like, oh no. I'm like, what? There were houses that had little chain link fences. Their yards went right up to Nanticoke Road, and the parking lot just, you know, appeared at the end where Seagull was. And she's like, "That's my sister's car. It was in the front yard of somebody's house." Yeah,
that's hilarious.
That was bad. So that kind of stuff, you know, that kind of stuff sort of happened. You know, at Hammerjacks, there was a huge security staff. And at the end of the night, I just remember them trying to get people to go home was like such a huge task. Because
right.
everybody, you talked about tailgating, it was like people didn't want the night to end, you know. So they were out in the parking lot, and they had this big crew of these huge, you know, guys in the like satin jackets, the hammer jacks. And they, it was
time
like
to go home!
Gotta get out of here! And it was like a cartoon to me. They would all kind of be in formation. It was like, they would like, and a big cloud of dust behind them. We're like, hey, get out of here! You know, and they turn around, hey, you!
I was never there at 4 a.m. I don't know what happened,
great.
You know.
It was its own separate little party afterwards, for sure.
Well, let's talk about the documentary. Steve Naranjo is here. Anne-Marie, John Allen. We're at Costa celebrating 31 years. All brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. You're going to get... I feel like Oprah in holidays. One for you. Holiday
nice.
Cash drops. I'm giving them away down here at Costas. We're having some fun. It's all brought to you by our friends at Goodwill, as well as Wind Donation. We're doing a best of sort of celebration the next couple of weeks, celebrating 31 years at WNST. These are the holiday cash drops. Our friends at Goodwill and Wind Donation as well. All right, so... documentary, I had some Vimeo secret handshake password, passcode thing. I didn't even know you had seen it, so he and I were like BSing about coming together today. When can people see this? Because I ain't driving into West Virginia to watch your damn thing.
Yes. It'll be ready before Christmas. So it should be streaming, depending on when this airs, streaming next week. It's ready to go. Streaming's all set.
So this is a Christmas gift, is what you're saying. Well, I brought your tree.
We got it timed perfectly, so it'll show up on like the 26th for everybody. But waiting on the DVD test copy to show up, which should be here Tuesday. So we're right there.
Man. Are you selling DVDs, or are you doing something?
You know what? I was going to do streaming. I said nobody cares about DVDs anymore. We put something up on Facebook. People are like, yes, please.
Yeah, I want to own it. I want to physically
own it. Same thing with soundtrack, where we talked about doing a soundtrack, and people are like,
you
yes,
got Blu-ray.
Dude. Yeah, right? We're doing a Blu-ray, man.
I need a VHS tape.
Yeah.
Beta? Turn
right.
on.
Well, that's right, man. And, you know, we're not stupid, so we just did it on a print-on-demand thing. It's just like, whatever.
Brilliant.
Is there a night, I guess is what I'm asking you, is there a night where you're going to put it up on a screen somewhere?
We're
all going to come and get
crunk.
We're working on a screening in Baltimore in February, and actually... John is planning on bringing Stone Horses to play, which is super exciting. I mean, for me, it's like,
I need to get the right night, so at least let me hold the date in my calendar.
Yeah.
So I'm not off seeing Springsteen or something.
Well, listen, hey, you know, we don't have a firm date yet, but it's going to be February. But for me, it's like, I don't care if we do the movie again. It's like, let the band play, man.
Right.
Let's have some beers and watch some music, right? But it's like, it's, you know, it'll be cool for a lot of people that have been waiting to see it. And for us, we're really encouraged because... you sit there for all this time. It's the same thing with music. You're in the studio, right? Where you're working on stuff. You sort of lose perspective. Is this thing good or not?
Right.
And then when we released it, I mean, for the first thing, Louis loved it, right? And he got to me after the screen. He's like, oh, well, I could have told you about embezzlement and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, man, you know? So he was on board, which was good because a lot of it's his story. You want to make sure that it's told in the way that he's happy with.
I'm glad he's still here to help tell it and
man,
be a part of it. And
it was really cool. And then, you know, the other thing that's been a big compliment for us is that clearly for people like us that were there, it brings back a lot of memories. But for like your son, for people that we've talked to that are younger that couldn't go there or just weren't in the area or whatever, they're like, man, I missed out. This seemed really, really cool.
And it was.
The concern was you're making it just for people that were there. It's like, well, is that all the only people that are going to watch it and really get it?
Right.
But people that weren't there are like, oh, my God, that looked like the best place to be. And it was, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a
really
big compliment for us.
Well, I appreciate you guys taking it on. I appreciate you thinking of me to tell a story or two and make people laugh and even love it a little bit. I even took a cheap shot at Mickey in the film. Perfect.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good one.
John Allen's here. I think you're going to hang out, right?
Yeah.
All right. And give everybody, like, how to find the film and what's going on and be in touch on this night in February.
Yeah, it's called Hammer Jacks the Rockumentary. You can find it on Facebook by just putting that in.
Fair enough.
And all the information you can find there. But our film company is called Varla Dogwood, so you can go to varladogwood.com, and that's where you can buy hard copies if you're interested in that.
Right.
So it's all available there.
And the soundtrack, you started
The soundtrack,
mentioning.
Man, is going to be really cool. It's double vinyl. Child's Play, unreleased.
DC Star?
DC Star is on it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Stone I started Horses. Singing Is It You when I like, saw them. I saw it at the time. I said to my wife, like, they were like really cool band.
Well,
man,
you talk about something that brings you back. The opening chords of that. Oh. I'm like, oh my God, it feels like I'm going to Shiley Acres, you know, it's like 1982.
I just had chills. Yeah. Oh, you get chills.
I know, man. That's music.
It is.
And that's another thing that's been great about making this is that people that I grew up listening to, I've gotten to meet, man. So I'm still like nerd out about it. I'm like, I get to go hang out with DC Star, man. This is awesome. You know, David Simmons from DC Star is like the coolest dude. And so,
I still have the picture disc of that record.
Oh, that's incredible. That's
vinyl,
so cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
Vinyl's heavy, John.
Yeah.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
Get a CD, dude.
But that's
stream
coming,
it.
That's coming out on Keith Roth's label, Main Man. Keith Roth is with SiriusXM, right? Hair Nation. So it's on his label. So double vinyl, there's going to be CD. We'll sell it as a package with a movie poster. So all that's going to be, you know, again, you can go to Facebook and see all the updates. But
awesome.
That'll be out for order. That should be pre-ordering next week.
All right, well, we got rock stars. I'm like an airport here. I got planes landing behind us. All the members, Love Riot, Beyond Words over there, Giving Love, Milkshake. You know, they've done the whole gamut, so I'm really looking forward to having them on. John's going to stick around and hang with us. Anything you want to say on the M3 thing and the Child's Play thing? Because I don't know that we're going to get into it once Sheena Shock happens, but you and I, were you at the Child's Play, Brian Jack?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, and I saw Mickey that night. I was with Brillhart and Kirk, and there's a picture of all of us. You were just working. You didn't even see me. I didn't see Aaron. I didn't see anybody.
Dude, I was there. I couldn't. I knew. I was talking to her. I was texting. I couldn't get to her because it was so packed.
Never even
saw each other.
Oh, I was in the middle of my crab cake tour. I drove back from Ocean City to come and be a part of it that night.
Yeah, that's awesome.
No.
Awesome,
I mean,
man.
I loved it. And you were fronting the band and
it
doing songs.
What
and,
a great show that was. Huh?
Being Izzy and Nick look like a rock star. So, like, for you with this Child's Play, give me, what's this going to be, M3? Have you figured this out yet or no?
Well, I think I have.
Well, so, why didn't I know that? I thought we were friends. I tell people we're friends. Maybe we're not.
Well, I've been hoping to get Child's Play on the M3 for a long time, and finally got the call. The guy hit me up, and I wasn't sure it was really going to happen or not, so I didn't want to put it out there. And then, you know, there's a feeling in the music business, I think, like, you know, when you say, oh man, my band's gonna get signed, and then that all goes away,
right?
You jinx it, right?
Yeah.
So I try not to be that superstitious, but it creeps in every once in a while. But yeah, I think
that was a big success that night in August. It really was.
You know, like you were saying, all the old friends that were there, were so many people that we knew, you know, we know from over the years. And my biggest focus on that show was to honor Brian, to do something special with, you know, put together a slideshow of all these pictures of the beginning of the band, when the band started out, and really heavily focus on photos of him, you know, him on a skateboard, you know, all the, like, the different things that he did, and then up through the band getting signed, doing the Rat Race tour and everything. And and I really wanted to make his family happy. And his child, Adrian, I wanted her to be happy about everything and have them involved. And then I think the M3 thing came about because of that show. I think they saw the reaction on Facebook, and they saw the videos of the crowd singing My Bottle. But
you guys were great that night. Like, I didn't know what to expect because of rehearsal.
I didn't either.
Listen, age gets to all of us. Yeah. You know, how important it is to you, how much you can actually do it in the way that you want to do it, because you're not 19 anymore, like, well, none of us are, right? And then to see, well, we're... Shit, Brian was he was the front of the band. Like, what are we... You know, you're missing him, right?
Yeah.
So, like, how good could it be without him? You know, you're sort of thinking, right? And it was just, it mattered so much to you. And I know you privately said this to me, that Nick took it on as, I mean, he was so good.
Yeah.
And it felt like, oh, my God, he's better than he was in 1990. Yeah. And I remember, I was there every night. It's not like you guys were a sloppy band or whatever, but you were kids.
Well,
and now all of a sudden, you know, when you put 2-3 months into saying... We're going to do an hour and a half as Toby Keith, as good as better than we've ever done it. Dude, I stand and applaud, and I thought, if that's the end, drop the hat. But then I see this thing happen this week, and you're on it, and you haven't even talked about it. And I thought, well, that's maybe this is your beautiful reward. The next 5-10 years, this is something you do. You know,
yeah. Like, who knows? I mean, I don't know where it takes us, but we, like you said, we started rehearsals for that very early. I wanted to do the show in April, but we just couldn't get it together. So we you know booked it for August, which is notoriously a terrible month for Baltimore. You know, everybody wants to get their last gasp going down to the beach. You know, but we did that show. We're going to try to do the same thing. We're going to try to rehearse months in advance and really be together for the show. You know, it's a different kind of thing, though. You know, those festivals, they just kind of throw you up there. It's
throw and go.
Yeah. So
and it's 103 degrees and it's 2:30 in the afternoon. You know, yeah, it is what it is, right?
You know, so but yeah, but I you know, we're going to be laser focused and try to, you know, give the best show that we can. For there's going to be a lot of people there that never saw the band before,
right.
So I think that's a big thing, and we're, you know, planning.
My wife,
yeah,
has never seen the band.
Hmm. She was sick as a dog.
It was a long story that week.
So, you know, we're going to have the original. I'm going to sing, and then we're going to bring Larry up for a couple of songs, introduce him, say, hey, this is the guy that started the band with Brian way back when, and try to honor everybody, you know.
Nice.
Like, you know, yeah.
I'll say something about that, man, is that, you know, they announce a lineup. Very few. It's hard for M3 to come up with a band that hasn't played yet,
right?
And it's also hard for them to come up with bands with so many original members, right? And so for people in the area, man, it's like when that came out. Everybody, I didn't hear people talking about other stuff. There was
Everybody was talking about, holy crap,
Child's Play on M3. Mm-hmm. Like, there was all, like, text back and forth. Everybody talking about it, man.
Cool.
Friends in Jersey, like, oh, my God, I'm going to go now because Child's Play is on the bill. So it's a big deal, man. It's going to be special.
You're making me tear up, man.
It's going to be great.
Well, I'm going to start drinking early that day.
Oh, dude, I'm going to start Friday.
By the time Stink shows up, and I won't even recognize Shane Watt.
Come sail away, whatever.
Anne-Marie, Steve, John Allen, we're at Costas. We had a huge holiday party here. I want to thank Pete and everybody for having us over here today. It's all brought to you by our friends at Goodwill, the Maryland Lottery. I'm giving away holiday. I tell you what, all these bands are going to get these holiday cash drops. Thanks to Roz over at the Maryland Lottery. You guys are all holding your tickets up.
Yeah, yeah.
If you win $100, you know, buy me some oyster stew or something.
I think I won the last time you gave.
We had a $100 winner here last year. We had a $50 winner 2 weeks ago at Pappas. So people really win. I've got a handful of Raven scratch-offs left as well. Our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. You buy two, you get two free. 0% finance. You just mention me. You didn't have to mention me. They'll give you the deal without all that. We're going to come back, continue on here for my 31st anniversary. We're at Costas. I've already had a little bit of food. We're going to have a crab cake and some crab and puree before it's all over with. And we're talking rock and roll, the Baltimore rock and roll. Gina Schock, our rock and roll Hall of Fame queen from Dundalk, will be here. John and I are looking forward to chatting more with her about that. All I remember, she ran out the door. I'm coming back for you guys. So 8 weeks later, here we are. We'll be together with Gina Schock. Beyond Words is up next, and Love Riot, Milk Shake, old friends. I'm going to make Joyce come up. And I think Joyce and George, and at some point Lisa's going to get up here, but it's going to continue on. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. We're Costa. Stay with us.